Good morning. Can we all come in and have a seat? I want to thank everybody for coming this morning. We have a very good turnout on a very rainy and uncomfortable day. And we should apologize for the frequent room changes and also for the slow start here. Today, the subject of our discussion today is the Iraqi Ministry of the Interior. The MOI in Iraq is responsible for the supervision, training, and administrative support of Iraq's non-military security forces. And these include the 275,300 members of the Iraqi Police Service, the 32,389 members of the Iraqi National Police, the 38,205 members of the Iraqi Border Enforcement Service, and roughly 140 to 150,000 members of the Facilities Protection Service. This is a force of nearly 500,000 men under arms, or a force that's three times the size of the new Iraqi Army, Navy, and Air Force combined. Despite the scope of its responsibilities and the very importance of its work, the Iraqi Ministry of the Interior has been a troubled institution. In December 2006, the Iraq Study Group report stated that the Iraq Ministry of the Interior was, and I quote, confronted by corruption, infiltrated by militia, and unable to control the police. The report said, and I quote, Iraqi police could not control crime and routinely engaged in sectarian violence, including the detention, torture, and execution of Sunnis. In July 2007, the Los Angeles Times reported that the Interior Minister had become, and I quote, a federation of oligarchs. It described a situation in which various floors of the building were controlled by hostile militia groups, a place where police officials moved between floors only when escorted by armed bodyguards, and where internal power struggles occasionally led to resolution by assassination of people in the parking lot. And in September 2007, the congressionally mandated Independent Commission on Security Forces of Iraq, the so-called Jones Commission, led by retired General Jones, reported that, and I quote, a central challenge confronting the development of effective civilian security forces in Iraq is the dysfunctional Ministry of Interior. Sectarianism and corruption are pervasive in the MOI and cripple its ability to accomplish its mission, unquote. The commission recommended that the Iraqi National Police were so heavily infiltrated by militia and deeply involved in death squad activities that they should be disbanded and reorganized. And even the current Interior Ministry, who everybody gives very good marks to, Jawad al-Balani, has himself called for the purging of sectarian elements from the ministry and its comprehensive reform. Today, we note that there are more than 100 U.S. and U.K. advisors that comprise the Ministry of the Interior transition team that are trying to make that happen. So the question is, how did this situation come about? What is the state of play and what's being done? We have gathered together a panel of experts who can discuss this because of their past experience in Iraq. I'll introduce people in the order in which they'll speak, and we'll hope that our third speaker will be with us by the time it's his turn. Our first speaker today will be Andrew Rathmo, who served in the Coalition Provisional Authority and is currently the director of a UK-funded program to rebuild the MOI. Matt Sherman, who's done two tours in Iraq, first as an advisor to the Interior Minister and second as a political advisor to the commander of the 1st Cavalry Division. And our missing member is Walter Redman, who served as a senior police advisor in Iraq and currently serves in the State Department office, which has responsibility for the Iraq police program. So with no further ado, let's begin and invite Andrew to come to the podium. Matt to come to the program.
Thank you, Bob, for inviting me here today, and thank you, USIP, for also inviting me out here. It's great to see a lot of former colleagues, former ministers that are here, particularly you, Ambassador Samuna. I thank you for coming. And Brian Marshall and Josh Paul and Mike De La Cruz and Will Sands. It's all great to see so many faces in the crowd. I have to start off, though, and say I was a bit intimidated by the title of the conference, Fixing the Ministry of Interior and the Police Service. It's a bit daunting, to say the least. And it kind of made me think back at kind of some of the advice that I gave to my former civilian and military colleagues and Iraqi colleagues when I was in Iraq, is saying, you know, we need to lower the bar. And if it's possible, bury the bar. And so I'm going to do that now by lowering expectations of what I'm going to have to say to you today. Mainly focus on some of the history, but then also put forward some suggestions for the present and the future as well. I'm very glad to have Andrew Rathmel up here as well, and hopefully Walt will come here soon. Because while we've agreed and disagreed on many issues throughout our time there, I've always appreciated their insights because those thoughts have been well constructed and well thought out and have been based upon not weeks on the ground, not months on the ground, but years on the ground. And I think there's a lot to be said for that, particularly here in Washington. Now, we just passed the 5-year anniversary for Iraq, and many people say, you know, why haven't we been able to do more? And why has the Ministry of Interior particularly gotten progressively worse? And I like to say, you know, we haven't been in Iraq for 5 years. We've been in Iraq 6 months, 10 times. Some people laugh at that and some people don't. But in many ways it's true, because the ministry that I came across when I initially landed in Baghdad in January 2004 was much different from then the ministry that I left. And there were many certain types of events that happened which changed the entire dynamics of it all. I advised 4 ministers over that time. We went through 3 different governments. And these types of changes, these institutional changes, had drastic effects that I don't know whether a lot of people fully appreciate. And we're about to actually go through another series of them. And maybe, hopefully, we might be a bit more prepared in order to deal with these coming changes over the course of the near future. You know, Andrew Rathmel wrote a very good paper called Fixing Iraq's Internal Security Forces back in November 2007. And I quote him here, is that the MOI reflects the political dynamics of post-Saddam Iraq and the arena in which many of these conflicts are fought out. And he's absolutely right. Because what's going on right now is a struggle for survival and supremacy more than anything else. And even though I departed working as an interior minister advisor at the end of 2005, the ministry has continued to change much. And right now, there's a potential for the ministry to grow even more, possibly more than 420,000 security forces by 2009, in addition to other types of ones that Bob also mentioned. But if there's any one issue that I'm going to hopefully make clear during today's talk, is that numbers are not the answer. We get wrapped up in numbers so much, not only with regards to our own forces, but more importantly, for the Iraq security forces and the Iraq police. And in my mind, that's really contributed to many of the difficulties and frustrations that we have today. Now, I'm just going to start off, and again, I apologize for giving part of my talk will be historical, but I think it's important because it reaffirms these points in a nuanced way, which many times gets missed in lots of the reports that are out there. And to kind of give you some important milestones about what certain types of efforts we did to try to address the problem, for better or for worse. And many people, you know, talked about the dissolving of the Ministry of Defense with CPA Order Number 2 in May of 2003. And it's important to recognize the Iraqi police were not dissolved by CPA order. A lot of people think that. It's not true. That happened to the defense, but not the interior ministry. It was a force of about 60,000 people during the regime, and many of them self-dissolved. But then also there was an effort to recall back many of them at that time. But what was evident was that there was a leadership vacuum. Many of the Sunni leadership had left. Many of the mid-level leadership had left. And what we quickly learned was that the old IPS were not postured, trained, or equipped in order to deal with the challenges of the new Iraq. And there were a number of issues, a number of events that came about which reaffirmed that, which I'll mention. But since the police were really the only security force that was in the country at that time, they were thrust to the front. Not prepared, but thrust to the front. And to deal with a challenge that they were not ready to do. There was also an effort, again at that time, under CJTF-7, which is the military installation that preceded MNFI, of where there was a real focus to have numbers of people, hire people off the streets, whether they're former police or current police. 30,000 in 30 days was one of the efforts. 60,000 in 60 days. They never reached those levels, in my opinion, thank God. But that was the type of approach that was going on. And the Minister of Interior at that time, Nouri Bedran, a secular Shia, had great frustrations with this because you had the MSCs, the multi-subordinate commands, divisions that were kind of out leading this recruiting effort, and he was in Baghdad. And there was a massive disconnect that was going on, and he didn't have control about who was being brought into his ministry. And that kind of started some of the frustrations that were going on. And we had come up, and this was before I arrived, but trying to have a 3-week training course for then those that we believed had been police before, and then an 8-week training course for those that were new. There was also at that time, in May of 2003, an assessment that was done, I believe by Department of Justice, I could be wrong.
Right.
Yeah. Which was looking at how many police advisors, U.S. police advisors, Western police advisors, would be needed for this environment. And based upon the challenges that we saw in Bosnia, the number was 6,500. That was not possible in any near term. But then by the fall of 2003, there was another assessment, and it was drawn down to 1,500. And that, too, was a great challenge, based upon what was needed in the immediate term. And by the spring of 2004, what was agreed to was 500 police advisors and 600 police trainers. But being able to get those individuals, while that decision was made, being able to have to get those individuals into country by the end of CPA was not possible. They've definitely made significant headway since then. And I'm sure if Walt Redmond comes here, he can attest that fact much more clearly than I can. Now, what the CPA also tried to do was to establish, work with Nouri Bedran, establishing a ministry that was a cross-section of the political parties within Iraq at that time. And so you set up six deputy ministers, some Sunni, some Kurds, some Shias, from some of the major political parties. You had one from the PDK, which is Barzani's party. You had some from Dawa. You had one from Iskiri at the time. You had Sunnis also that were there that had previously worked within the ministry and knew how it worked. And then you also then had the minister himself, who was a member of the INA, which was Ali Alawi's party. And this was purposely done so that there wouldn't be any one party's political control over the ministry because of its vital importance. But eventually, as time went on, that changed, and that dynamic in many ways evaporated. But what we also had were a series of events which showed that the police weren't necessarily up to the fight, and that also that we were doing institutional changes that were frustrating many of the Iraqi leadership and also may have been premature in our own actions, and I'll get to that. The big one was the May 28th First Sadr Uprising, which showed that the police weren't able to fight this type of battle. But then again, I make the argument that no police force would be able to fight this. And that kind of started making people think that, you know, maybe something more needed to be done, not only with being able to ramp up the Ministry of Defense Forces, but also a different take on how the police should be dealt with. But then there was also an order that was signed, CPA Order 71, in April of 2004, which decentralized lots of the powers out of the ministry into the provinces. And this was, again, at the era where there was a push to send power down to the local level. And there was lots of fighting internally that went on with this, and most vocally the minister and, at the time, Paul Bremer. Because Norrie, I think, wanted to be able to remain that, to keep that control going on, because we didn't know who we were going to be passing this power on to. But this law was signed, and it, in many ways, I think, frustrated our efforts. Not because power should not be pushed down, but it's when to making sure that the instruments and the resources that we have are available to help receive that power and make sure that the Iraqis that we work with are able to receive that, and who is gaining that power. And there was also a focus, instead of focusing on the ministry, there was a focus on developing local police stations as well, which also frustrated, I think, Mr. Bedran. And eventually this led to his resignation in April of 2004. Following his resignation, we had another minister, Samir Samudai, who didn't have a security background, but had a very extensive background in management and organizations. And this was, in our mind, a real strength and something that he really applied his time to, by trying to vet the MOI leadership, making that a priority, setting up a thing called a qualifying committee, which was trying to then go through and identify who the police were and then set up avenues to, in order to kind of get rid and to provide training or other types of vocational training for those individuals who were not able to serve in the police forces. And he also set up an inspector's general office, which was completely new to much of the Iraqi system, but also vitally important. And also, I think, most importantly, he lent his support towards militia demilitarization and saw that this was a huge impending problem even before it came to the levels that we know today. Unfortunately, his promising apolitical reform agenda was cut short with the dissolving of the CPA in June, which then brought in, again, another set of agendas, another government. But we also saw during that time, when Minister Samudai was there, a real change by the military. And you established CPAT, the Civilian Police Assistance Training Team, which were the ones that were going to take the effort of training and equipping the police forces, because the office that I was involved in did not have the resources or the reach to do that. We were a team of, it varied between 40 and 8 people that were trying to get equipment out and link with the various MSCs and deal with the issues of the ministry and also the crises, the growing crises of the day. And so the establishment of CPA, but the establishment of CPAT was to try to rectify some of those problems. And you also had in that time, in May 2004, the establishment of MNFI as a replacement to CJTF7. Which then created MNSTICI, which is Multinational Support Transition Command in Iraq, which was then led by Lieutenant General, David Petraeus. And he took this effort in a much more robust and active direction. With the new government, the transitional Iraqi government, this was the one that was led by Prime Minister Alawi. The minister that we then had to deal with at that time was Faleh al-Nakib. And again, we're resetting ourselves for a new type of challenges, a new type of individuals, new types of relationships. Knowing that this government will only be around probably for 9 months, and then there will be another one. And so what can we then accomplish in the short term and try to make things better? He came from an approach of being very, he came from a very strong military family. His father, I believe, was chief of staff of the army prior to the Saddam regime. And he was also very concerned about Iranian influence, not only within the country, but also within his ministry, and really took an active approach towards trying to weed them out in whatever means he thought necessary. And he also was part of the agreement with General Petraeus to say, you know, we need to ramp up the police force, the regular police, because they were 60,000 about during 2003. They eventually kind of were thinking of going up to about 80,000. But General Petraeus thought we need to do 135,000 police. And Minister Naqib agreed to that. And so General Petraeus did everything he can to make sure those numbers were reached. And there was a lot of that time of debate on whether which are these police forces, what type of form are they supposed to take? Supposed to be a more community-based approach? Should it be a more type of paramilitary approach? And the approach that Naqib wanted, because of his military background, was more paramilitary, and he saw some of the challenges that were growing within Iraq, and there not being a strong Iraqi army, and so he started his own force outside of the command of Minsticky and us, called the Commandos, which are now known as the National Police. And the Commandos were teamed up, was led by his uncle, Adnan Thabit. And what really crystallized in his mind was the second Sadr uprising in August, and that there was really no ability for us really to fight back strong with them. He didn't see an ability for the ministry to do that, and the Ministry of Defense was still in its infancy. And so this is what pushed him in order to create these commandos. And these commandos initially were made up of Republican Guard, Special Republican Guard. They were individuals who we wanted to bring back into the force. But having said that, also, not necessarily doing police activities, but also there were also problems that we had with them in many ways with regards to human rights issues and with regards to command and control. But they were the Iraqis, they were the minister's creation, and they had his earnest support. And at the time, while they again had they had lots of problems, they were the most effective Iraqi force that we had, dealing with conflicts in Mosul, Samarra, parts of Baghdad. And eventually it was because of these commandos that they became a target, a political target, because they were, again, they weren't under the command of MNFI, and they could then and could go around the country and do things as they saw fit. And so come the January 2005 elections, we then had another situation of where new set of elections, new government, the Iraqi interim government, new minister, Bayan Jaber, and the United Iraqi Alliance, the main Shia party, was the dominant winner in this, and his party, Skiri, was the primary benefactor. And they could have had the choice in any ministry they wanted, but they chose, in my mind, to have the Ministry of Interior, one, because of so many resources that were being poured in it, but also, more importantly, because of these commandos. And that, one, they saw them as a threat, because a lot of these guys were Special Republican Guard guys that had fought against some of the Skiri elements before, but also could be used as a tool if they were to change them and in order to achieve some of their own goals that they had in mind and eliminate some of the threats that they saw, that they believed they saw around them. And this was a big change. And eventually, you started seeing reports coming up about how the commandos were involved in targeting of Sunni groups primarily. And we saw a big change in the sense of it wasn't necessarily, though, just Sunnis carte blanche. You have to remember, and you have to always think through, there's a reason why all the violence happens in Baghdad. We kind of get lost within the violence, just thinking that it's Sunnis on Shias, and that's not necessarily true. It's much more nuanced. There's a reason for a lot of the attacks that go on. And one of the ones that you may have seen was the Jadriya bunker, which is where lots of these commando forces went out, detained a lot of individuals, and put them in this bunker. And you go in there, and you saw about quite a few hundred individuals in there that were being tortured and things of that such. But then you do some history, and a lot of these individuals were then tied in some form or fashion to being involved in putting down the Shia uprisings that happened following the first Gulf War. And so there's always history that goes on. And so you started seeing these forces being used in order to achieve other types of means that we did not intend in happening. And so we're continuing to grow these forces, thinking that we're fixated on the, if we get, stand up the forces, that then we can then draw our own down. But they're being used in other means that go contrary to what we have. But then there were elections at the end of 2006, and that brought in then Minister Balani, who was a compromise candidate, someone who had ties to Fadila Party, a lesser-known Shia party, has ties to Chalabi, but not necessarily that strongly. And he was weak in many ways. But he's gone about trying to bring about change. There was an incident, you may have read, a Site 4 national police humanitarian human rights issue that came up. And he then removed many of the leadership that were in the commandos at that time. Didn't necessarily fire them, just moved them. But has gone about trying to bring about those other types of small changes, subtle changes, that is direly needed. He also replaced at the time the Deputy Minister of Police. And he continues to try to make pragmatic changes, but in a highly political and violent area. So what is the way that we go forward on this? Because throughout my time, the numbers of police have continued to rise, but the problems and challenges continue to grow. And right now, the MOI has authorized 360,000 police, border forces, and national police. And it's not so much the ministry itself is not necessarily lost. It's not a lost ministry. It's an overwhelmed ministry. This is an institution that was only supposed to deal with, was designed during the regime to only deal with 60,000 individuals, police at most. And it's just been overrun by this. And the amount of numbers that we were trying to, individuals that we were trying to crank out, 2004, 5, 6, 7 now, really just frustrates the entire area, effort, and is then abused. I mean, there's a capacity gap between what we can provide and what they can sustain. Now, I'm of the opinion that if we are going to continue to train police, army, whoever, we also must be willing to draw back or hold back the training. We're too fixated on thinking that if we can just produce more people, that we then can get our own forces out. And that's wrong. Because these forces are being used in ways that we did not contemplate, that we cannot control. And we need to try to be able then, if we are going to continue to provide equipping and training, to use it in more strategic ways. To use it in ways in where you can get certain concessions, you have greater control over who is actually going to be trained, greater insight on who these individuals are. Because throwing resources at this problem is not the way towards fixing it. I think we have a lot of political influence that's left. But I think there's a strategic way, much better strategic way, in which it can be applied. Now, there's going to be an upcoming shift that'll be happening with the provincial elections and also the national elections within 2009 yet again. And you also had most recently the passage of the Provincial Powers Law, which will further decentralize power down to the provinces. I don't know if people fully appreciate yet really what that means. If you read the Provincial Powers Law, it says that the provincial governor controls the police. He controls all the security services minus the military. And there's going to be a lot of individuals who are going to gain power in these elections that may have viewpoints, opinions, political positions that are definitely contrary to our own and may not be complementative of what the national government wants. But they will be receiving power with these elections, for better or for worse. What we can do, though, is to reposition our efforts. And I know we've been doing a lot at the provincial level, and I wish Walt was here to be able to explain what's happening on now, because I have not been as intimately involved in this as he. But to make sure our police trainers and advisors are there with the PRTs in order to work with the institutions and the individuals who will be receiving this power. And also to work with the provincial chiefs of police in being able to develop and hold accountable police plans that they wish to implement on a quarterly, twice yearly, or yearly basis, and be willing to hold back things, to use our resources in order to try to bring about change. Now, I'll just conclude on this point. What we also need to recognize are the limits of our own power. We cannot do it all, nor should we. But I think we have a responsibility, moral obligation, I would argue, of where it is our job to try to provide an opportunity for reform and then help the Iraqis do things themselves, not do it for them. Because, and I'm not going to make any friends with this comment, people ask me, should the military be the one in charge of this operation? Should the State Department? Should justice? And I say none of them are prepared in order to deal with this certain types of challenge. They're not organized to do it in this type of scope, this type of complexity. And so, perhaps as a possible conference idea, future conference idea, we could also think about not necessarily how the MOI could be better structured, but also how we can be better structured in order to deal with these challenges, because there's certainly lots of room for improvement on that side as well. Thank you very much for your time.